Novodot is unveiling a new attention-grabbing way to get drivers to slow down. You want to plug your ears. It's called the LRAD. It's a long-range acoustic device that blares a loud siren, like you just heard, with a verbal warning to drivers about slowing their vehicles down. MoDOT has bought two of the devices to get drivers to slow down in work zones. The loud sound can penetrate even a well-insulated vehicle with the radio on, delivering an urgent message to those who have not moved out of a work zone lane to get over immediately.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound, a dimension of sight, a dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into...
Suicide. 10 seconds. 9, 8, 7, 6. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, blast off.
It doesn't matter why I was there, where the air is sterile and sheets sting. It doesn't matter that I was hooked up to this thing that buzzed and beeped every time my heart leaped like a man whose faith tells him God's hands are big enough to catch an airplane or a world. It doesn't matter that I was curled up like a fist protesting death, that every breath was either hard labor or hard time, or that it was always too hot or too cold. Doesn't matter because my hospital roommate wears Star Wars pajamas, and he's 9 years old. His name is Lewis, and I don't have to ask what he's got. The bald head with the skin and bones frame speaks volumes. The Game Boy and the feather pillow booms like they're trying to make him feel at home because he's going to be here a while. I manage to smile the first time I see him, and it feels like the biggest lie I've ever told, so I hold my breath. Because I'm thinking any minute now he's going to call me on it. I hold my breath because I'm scared of a 57-pound boy hooked up to a machine because he's been watching me and maybe I got him pegged all wrong, like maybe he's bionic or some shit. So I look away, like I just made eye contact with a gang member who's got a rap sheet the length of a lecture on dumb mistakes politicians have made. I look away like he's going to give me my life back the moment I got something to trade. I damn near pull out my pack and say, cigarette? But my fear subsides in the moment I realize Lewis is all show and tell. He's got everything from a shotgun shell to a crow's foot, and he can put them all in context. Like, see, this is from a shooting range, and see, this is from a weird girl. I watch his hands curl around a cufflink and a tie tack and realize that every knick-knack is a treasure, and every treasure's got a story, and every time I think I can't handle more, he hits me with another story. He says, see, this is from my father, see, this is from my brother, see, this is from that weird girl, see, this is from my mother. It took me about 2 days to figure out that that weird girl is his sister. Took him about 2 hours today after she left for him to figure out he missed her. They visit every day and stay well past visiting hours because for them that term doesn't apply. But when they do leave, Lewis and I are left alone, and he says the worst part about being sick is that you get all the free ice cream you ask for. And the worst part about that is realizing that there's nothing more they can do for you. And there's no easy way of asking, and I already know what he's going to say, but maybe he just needs to say it, so I ask him anyway, are you scared? Lewis doesn't even lower his voice when he says, fuck yeah. I listened to a 9-year-old boy say the word fuck up, like he was a 30-year-old man with a nosebleed being lowered into a shark tank, he's got a right to it. And if it takes this kid a curse word to help him get through it, then I want to teach him to swear like the devil's sitting there taking notes with a pen and a pad. But before I can forget that Lewis is 9 years old, he says, please don't tell my dad. He asks me if I believe in angels. And before I realize I don't have the heart to tell him, I tell him, not lately. And I just lay there waiting for him to hate me. But he doesn't know how to, so he never does. Lewis loves like a man who lived in a time before God gave religion to men and left it to them to figure out what hate was. He never greets me with silence, only smiles and a patience I've never seen in someone who knows they're dying. And I'm trying so hard not to remind him that I'll be out of here in a couple days smoking cigarettes and taking my life for granted. And he'll still be planted in this bed like a flower that refuses to grow. I've been with him for 5 days, and all I really know is Lewis loves to pull feathers out of his pillow then watch them float to the ground. almost as if he's the philosopher inside of the scientist, ready to say it's gravity that's been getting us down. But the truth is, there's not enough miracles to go around, kid. And there's too many people petitioning God for the winning lotto ticket. And for every answered prayer, there's a cricket with arthritis. And the only reason we can't find answers is because the search party didn't invite us. And Lewis, right now, the crickets have arthritis, so there's no music. No symphony of nature swelling to crescendos, if we bend halos into melodies that can keep rhythm with the way our hearts beat. So we must meet silence with the same level of noise that the parents of dying 9-year-old boys make when they take liberties in talking with heaven. We must shout until we shatter in our own vibrations, then let our lives echo and grow echo and grow echo and grow distant. Distant enough to know that as far as our efforts go, we don't always get a reply. But I swear to whatever God I can find in the time I have left, I'm going to remember you, kid. I'm going to tell your story as often as every story you told me. And every time I tell it, I'll say, see, there's bravery in this world. There's 6.5 billion people curled up like fists protesting death. But every breath we breathe has to be given back. A 9-year-old boy taught me that. So hold your breath. The same way you'd hold a pen when writing thank you letters on your skin to every tree that gave you that breath to hold. Then let it go. As if you understand something about getting old and having to give back. Let it go like a laugh attack in the middle of really good sex. The black eye will be worth it. Because what is your night worth without a story to tell? And why wield a word like worth if you've got nothing to sell? People drop pennies down a wishing well as the cost of desire is equal to that of a thought. But if you've got expectations, expect others have bought your exact same dream for the price of the hard work, hang in, hold on mentality. Like I accept any challenge, so challenge me. Like I brought a knife to this gunfight, but the other night I mugged a mountain, so bring that shit. I've had practice. Lewis and I cracked this world wide open, found the prize inside who's never lied to ourselves, never told ourselves we'd be easier on demanding, never dreamt of anyone handing us anything, so we sing in our own vibration. We dare angels to eavesdrop, to stop mid-flight, to pluck feathers from their wings and write demands that God's hands take the time to catch you. So that even if God doesn't, it wasn't because we didn't try. I don't often believe in angels. But on the day I left, Lewis pulled a feather from his pillow and said, "This is for you." I half expected him to say, "See? This is the first one I grew."
This is the conspiratorial view of history, as opposed to the accidental view. And it is the conspiratorial view that we shall present in this program.
To the Batmobile. Let's go.
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Ready to move out.
Each week, American History TV's Real America brings you archival films that help tell the story of the 20th century and often puts current events in historical context.
Hello, boys and girls. I have a special message for you from the President of the United States. Let me read it to you. I salute the boys and girls who are buying United States savings stamps and bonds through the Treasury School Savings Program. They're learning the lessons of practical citizenship and of wise money management. And they're giving important support to the cause of freedom and the men who fight for us in Vietnam. That message is on this wallet-size U.S. Savings Bonds pledge card, which you'll get in school as soon as you begin to buy U.S. savings stamps. Let's get started today. What do you say?
I call that the ultimate bridge to nowhere.
chimpanzees have gone on the run in Kansas. Yet zoo officials from Kansas City Zoo
in the state of Missouri
say a group of chimpanzees escaped on Thursday and went on a little wander. How did they escape? Well, apparently one of the chimps placed a massive log against the wall, allowing him and six of his pals to scurry up the log and over the wall. They ended up in an area only zookeepers can enter.
In the state of Missouri!
Oh, naughty chimps. As a precautionary measure, visitors at the zoo were asked to stay indoors, and the zoo was closed. However, their fun didn't last for long. Zookeepers eventually got them back into their enclosures, tempting them with carrots, celery, lettuce, and molten milk balls. Carter captured this terrifying moment when passengers on a New York subway realized the doors had closed, trapping a big rat on the train with them. While commuters often feel like their journey is a rat race, these passengers got an entirely different experience, jumping on their seats and screaming as the rat scurried around the carriage. Unsurprisingly, a lot of passengers got off at the next stop, continuing their journey elsewhere. But the final destination of the rat remains unknown. African grey parrot has become the talk of the town after he came to his owner's rescue during a random attack in a North London park.
You've been a good bird. Yeah, I love you. Hey.
Rachel Marino was taking her pet parrot Onesie for a walk when she was shoved to the ground by a man who approached her from behind. Luckily, Onesie spotted the man and began flapping his wings and squawking loudly to scare off the attacker.
Am I being mean? I'm sorry. And then as he got closer, she kind of turned around and was just watching him. I'm like, it's okay, Onesie, it's fine, it's just someone's behind. And then all of a sudden, bam, just kind of, you know, grabbed me around my neck. My initial thought was someone was trying to kill my bird or steal or I don't know what. And I was just kind of left shocked, happy that my bird was still with me and alive, and glad that I was still alive as well.
The 25-year-old and the parrot were left unharmed, and police are appealing for information about the attack.
Could talk to the animals. Just imagine it, chatting to a chimpanzee. Imagine talking to a tiger, chatting to a cheetah. What a neat achievement it would be. If we could talk to the animals, learn their languages, maybe take an animal degree. We'd study elephants and eagles, buffalo and beagle, alligator, guinea pig, and flea. gun voice in polar bear and python, and we would curse in fluent a kangaroo. If people ask us, can you speak rhinoceros? Yeah, we'd say, of course, of us. Can't you do? If we confer with our furrier friends, man to animal, think of all the things we could discuss. If we could walk with the animals, talk with the animals, grunt and squeak and squawk with the animals, and they could talk to us.
If we can solve it with what
ever happened. I'm scared of them. I don't know about that.
We spoke slang to
the orangutan. Take a fool to see it. That's speak in antelope and turtle. Our Pekingese would be extremely good if we were asked to sing in hippopotamus. Yeah, we'd say nodamus. And we are sure every octopus, plaice and platypus certainly would see it as a plus if we could walk with the animals, talk with the animals, grunt and squeak and squawk with the animals.
Jock scientists held a press conference in front of everyone to announce that they finally discovered the gay gene in fellow scientist Dr. Carl Silver.
After years of research, we now have definitive proof the gay gene exists in Carl.
It's in his butt.
The Jock scientists say these new findings come after months of experiments, including studying Carl's reaction to spiders down his shirt and just looking at him. The Jock scientists say their study could have far-reaching implications.
We are advising all female Americans to continue not eating lunch with Carl and reminding everyone to keep hot dogs and bananas away from Carl, as he will probably try to marry them.
Jack scientists warn that their next undertaking may not be so successful, saying, quote, "We're going to use the electron microscope to try and find Carl's boner. It may take years." Coming up next, the U.S. says it's willing to hold talks with Edward Snowden if they can kill him.
Finish him!
Democrats, they want to put limits on political donations. Nancy Pelosi has a surefire way to get it done. Listen to this.
When it comes to individual races, it's donor's choice, and it's just really a bad idea. And shall we say, ironic thing, or maybe ironic is not the word, is that we have to raise money to win the election so we can reduce the role of money in politics.
Ironic? Yeah, I'd say that was ironic. First, remember, it was pass the bill so we could read what's in it.
Then she said that the jobs figure last week proved that now we are at the same level of jobs that we were back before the recession began, which in raw numbers is true, but it doesn't mention all the people that have pulled out, the millions and millions of people that have pulled out of the job market. I mean, she provides statistics that even a seven-year-old could not believe in. I mean, these are just so obviously incorrect, some of the things she's saying. Now she's talking about the Democrats' raising of money. I mean, you know, come on. She adds hypocrisy to a level of counting that would not be accepted in any junior high school. So I really believe that she has become an embarrassment to the Democratic Party, and future generations will look back and say, how could she have been elected?
She was the Speaker of the House.
She was the Speaker.
My personal favorite. Extraordinary. She said, food stamps give the best bang for the buck.
If you got the money, honey, I've got the time to go honky-tonking, and we're gonna have a time. We'll make all the night spots dance to the music fine. If you got the money, honey, I got the time. Well, ain't no use to tarry, so let's start out tonight. We'll spread joy, oh, oh, and we'll spread it right. We'll have more fun, baby, all the way down the line. If you got the money, honey, I got the time.
The Obama administration has been accused of crony capitalism in the past. If you recall, the Cash for Clunkers program cost taxpayers $2.85 billion. And then who can forget the $527 million taxpayers lost to Solyndra, the solar panel company that didn't work. But our next guest says now Republicans have a chance to end one bad policy before it's too late. Senator from Utah, Mike Lee, joins us live. Good morning to you, Senator.
Morning, Steve. It's good to be with you.
We've heard a lot about crony capitalism in Washington, D.C. for years now. Tell us a little bit about the Ex-Im Bank. What is it and what is it supposed to do?
This is a bank set up by the federal government that's designed to give special financing options, making those options available to those who buy U.S. products that are sold overseas. Only problem is financing for these products is available on the commercial market. At least it would be if the government weren't getting in the way, if the government weren't in there giving a special sweetheart deal to certain favorites of the federal government.
Sure, and talk about favorites. We got a graphic we're going to put up. In 2012, loan guarantees went out to the tune of almost $15 billion. But here's the thing, $12 billion was for Boeing. Why does Boeing, which is, I think, the world's biggest plane maker, if not Airbus, why do they need billions of dollars to do business overseas?
Well, that's a very good question, and that's exactly the question that I'm asking here.
An organization as large as the United States government, some things are bound to slip through the cracks. But how about an entire building? Actually, how about tens of thousands of buildings, all sitting empty at taxpayer expense? Here's Jeff Pagase.
No one has been coming to work in the USDA Cotton Annex building for some time. Just blocks away from the White House, it's been vacant for 6 years. It's one of 77,000 empty buildings the government continues to own and maintain, costing taxpayers $1.5 billion a year in electric bills, roof repairs, and other monthly costs. What's more, a recent audit found part of the reason those costs are so high is that the government can't keep track of what buildings it owns and what shape they're in.
Oh,
learn the rules on how to love and live your life. But think about it twice. The pusher push, the fixer fix, the judge of quits, the junkie use his life for the dollar bill. For the dollar bill. You wear the dollar bill. For the dollar bill. You wear the dollar bill. You don't buy a life, you live a life. A father learns much too late. He was never home. He worked two jobs and went at home. He had to cross.
Benjamin Franklin, who once said that nothing in this world is certain except death and taxes. And with tax day just over a month away for the majority of Americans, that notion is becoming more and more of a reality. Except for one group of people, well, at least they're people, according to Mitt Romney. Yes, I'm talking about multinational corporations. According to a new report by Bloomberg, the largest U.S.-based companies added $206 billion to their offshore profits in 2013 and have now compiled $1.9 trillion outside of the U.S. That number represents a nearly 12% increase in offshore profits from last year. Now, amazingly, just three mega corporations are responsible for nearly a fifth of that money. These companies are Microsoft, Apple, and IBM. Since 2010, the amount of money these companies have placed in tax-friendly countries has skyrocketed. IBM now has over $52 billion in offshore profits, Apple $54 billion, and Microsoft a whopping $76 billion. But it's not just tech giants taking advantage of the huge loopholes in the tax code. This chart of the top 10 companies with the largest offshore profits shows every industry from banking to pharmaceuticals to big oil placing billions of federally untaxable dollars in non-U.S. bank accounts. General Electric leads the pack by a mile with $110 billion placed offshore. And according to a Congressional Research Service report from last year, large U.S.-based companies earned 43% of their overseas profits in countries with extremely lax tax laws, such as Bermuda, Luxembourg, and Ireland. The report estimates that the revenue loss for the U.S. government due to this practice is as much as $90 billion a year. Now, this study comes on the heels of a stunning 2012 report by the Tax Justice Network that found that the super rich have at least $21 trillion hiding in tax havens across the world. Let me repeat that. $21 trillion, a number the author of the study called a huge black hole in the world economy. And that's a conservative estimate. Now, if you still can't comprehend what $21 trillion looks like, consider that $1 trillion is 1 million dollar bills. A huge reason why this money is so difficult to tax and track is due to the extreme banking secrecy and protection laws in countries like Switzerland. But in the U.S., Congress could pass laws to make it more difficult for multinational companies to continually abuse the tax system. Now, a common argument is to lower the corporate tax rate, which currently sits at 35%, to incentivize companies to bring profits back home. But the problem is that lowering the tax rate would cause such a large loss in revenue that any benefit from corporations keeping their money in the U.S. would be negated. Not to mention that according to a 2010 government accountability report, profitable U.S. corporations actually only paid an average federal tax rate of just over 12%, thanks to the same loopholes and havens. So instead, perhaps we should look to Representative Lloyd Doggett and Senator Carl Levin, who have tried to pass a bill that would give more authority to the Treasury and IRS to go after offshore tax abuse, establish fines and penalties for the practice, and strengthen detection of offshore activity. But to almost no one's surprise, the bill has gotten nowhere. Because in a corporatocracy, one thing's for sure, you don't stab your donors in the back.
Don't let money change you.
Department of Health and Human Services issued a new report this week indicating that the leading cause of death in the U.S. is God needing another angel. According to the study, God's continuing lack of souls too beautiful for this world accounted for over 700,000 deaths in the U.S. in 2013. A spokesperson announced the findings this morning.
For years, death was a seemingly random force, able to take us at any time via thousands of terrifying causes. However, we now know that mostly it is because our loving Father needs more angels to live with him forever in heaven.
Other common causes of death, according to the study, include God having a plan for us all, it being someone's time, and the Lord working in mysterious ways. Secretary of Health and Human Services Kathleen Sebelius noted that these statistics won't decrease until God decides he has enough sweet baby angels to help him paint rainbows in the sky, but urged all Americans to check their website for warning signs that they or a loved one might be at risk.
We've exhausted the numbers of all the deaths over the past 20 years, and the truth is irrefutable. We will see 100% of these people again very, very soon.
The in-depth report also broke down death by demographics, saying that most gregarious overweight Americans died because their hearts were simply too big, and 100% of murderers finally got what's coming to them. Next up, the Icelandic government completes its brand new Bjork habitat.
She asked me, son, when I grow old, will you buy me a house of gold? And when your father turns to stone, will you take care of me? She asked me, son, when I grow old, will you buy me a house of gold? And when your father turns to stone, will you take care of me? I will make you queen of everything you see. I'll put you on the map. I'll cure you of disease. Oh. Let's say we up and left this town and turned our future upside down. We'll make pretend that you and me lived ever after happily. She asked me, son, when I grow old, will you buy me a house of gold? And when your father of me, I will make you green of everything you see. I'll put you on a map. I'll cure you of disease. Oh, and since we know that dreams are dead and life turns plans up on their heads, I will plan. I'll put you on the map. I'll cure you of disease.
Was he a real threat, or did the school go too far? News 12 New Jersey's Douglas Clark has more from Sussex County.
Seventh grader Ethan Chaplin has been home from his school in Vernon for 2 days after getting in trouble in math class. He says he was just twirling a pencil with a pen cap on it.
And I was just holding it like this, or like twisting it around.
The student behind him yelled out, "He's making gun motions, send him to juvie."
Ethan says the other student had bullied him earlier in the day and was now trying to retaliate. But the school told Ethan he was suspended pending the outcome of a psychological evaluation.
I'm livid. I'm absolutely livid. I think it's gross misconduct at its finest. They took something so minimal and took it so far over the edge.
We spoke with the superintendent by phone. He says school policy and the law mandates he investigate whenever anyone in a school feels threatened or uncomfortable with the actions of another student.
We never know what's percolating in the mind of children, okay? And when they demonstrate behaviors that raise red flags, we must do our duty.
During questioning, Ethan says administrators did not listen to his side of the story.
I was shocked because I'm like, how am I not going to come back to school for it? I didn't even do anything.
Ethan underwent a 5-hour physical and psychological evaluation, which came back clean. He's now waiting on word about when he can return to school.
A young cowboy named Billy Joe grew restless on the farm. A boy filled with wanderlust who really meant no harm. He changed his clothes and shined his boots and combed his dark hair down. And his mother cried as he walked out, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill."
At this point, we want to get you up to speed on some other stories we're following for you right now. It is about 12:20 in Los Angeles, where a police officer has been injured after shots rang out at a police department traffic bureau late Monday night.
An individual described only now as a male black walked into the lobby of the West Traffic Division you see behind me, and for an unknown reason began shooting at the officer that was assigned to the front desk. That officer was struck multiple times by gunshots from the suspect.
And all of this took place just a short while ago. The Los Angeles police chief also says the injured officer was very lucky and brave. Despite being hit, he returned fire.
Don't take your guns to town. He laughed and kissed his mom and said, "You're Billy Joe's a man. I can shoot as quick and straight as anybody can. But I wouldn't shoot without a cause. I'd gun nobody down." But she cried again as he rolled away. "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill."
Investigators in Philadelphia are trying to identify three men involved in a wild shootout inside a motel. Surveillance video caught the men chasing each other through the building last month. They exchanged gunfire as motel guests ducked and ran for safety. Amazingly, no one was hurt. The shooters ran from the building before police arrived.
Don't take your guns to town. He stopped and walked into a bar and laid his money down. But his mother's words echoed again. "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." He drank his first strong liquor then to calm his shaking hand. Tried to tell himself at last he had become a man. A dusty cowpoke at his side began to laugh him down. And he heard again his mother's words, "Don't take your guns to town."
The owners of a Kitsap County gun shop worry a stash of stolen handguns could end up being used in other crimes. Coming for us, Kristen Drew is live in Gorst, where detectives hope surveillance video will lead them right to the burglars. Kristen?
Mary, ATF agents are now taking inventory here. They're trying to figure out exactly how many guns were stolen.
Thought we had everything covered.
Bill Borner thought he had every nook and cranny secure in his firearms store. But detectives say a criminal figured out a way to get inside and steal more than a dozen guns.
But I'm not happy I lost them. But it could have been worse for me, so, and for the public.
The store's security system captured the suspect in a back room. You can't see the suspect's face because the person wore a mask and hooded sweatshirt. When the alarm went off, it scared the criminal, but not enough to stop him from taking anything. The owner estimates the suspect stole at least 17 guns from this cabinet.
Rage, then Billy Joe reached for his gun to draw. But the stranger drew his gun and fired before he even saw. As Billy Joe fell to the floor, the crowd all gathered round and wondered at his final words. Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.
A standoff between federal land managers and hundreds of armed protesters in Nevada has finally come to an end. Officials confirm they've released some 400 cattle, all belonging to a rancher in southern Nevada who has refused a court order to stop grazing his cattle on public land. Authorities seized the cattle, and that drew the demonstrators, and they demanded the animals be returned to their rancher, Cliven Bundy. Officials say the cattle were released due to, quote, escalating tensions.
Jesus said to them, "My wife, she is able to be my disciple." Those words found on a tiny piece of papyrus have caused an uproar. The papyrus, which became known as the Gospel of Jesus' Wife when first revealed publicly in 2012, has now been scientifically dated to approximately the 8th century. But many still believe it's nothing more than a forgery. And that is just part of the raging debate over this document. Joining us now from Boston is Karen King, professor of divinity at Harvard University's Divinity School. Professor King originally announced the existence of this papyrus fragment in Rome in September of 2012. She is the author of a new report in the Harvard Theological Review, Jesus Said to Them, My Wife, a New Coptic Fragment. Karen, great of you to be with us. So we have chemical dating, thorough analysis indicating that this is authentic, but many people are standing by the belief that it's a fake. The Harvard Review also published a rebuttal to your work written by a professor of Egyptology at Brown University. He said that the fragment was so fake that it seems ripe for a Monty Python sketch, and that he thinks it could have been done in an afternoon by a graduate student. He even said that he didn't even need to bother investigating the papyrus to know it was a fake because of grammatical blunders and because it contains the same mistake as the so-called Gospel of Thomas. What do you say to him?
Well, of course, I've already replied to him in an article in the Harvard Theological Review. He had access to all of the materials that the scientists produced. He had access to my article as well. And it was a real disappointment to me that he decided that all of that material was irrelevant and that the discussion that he had, the decisions he'd been made, this kind of language, as you have already pointed out, about it being 100% clear that it was a fake, didn't actually require looking at the data. So I suppose that what I do is I point to the data, and in particular the arguments he makes about it being copied from a book called the Gospel of Thomas. Of course, the Gospel of Thomas existed in antiquity, and this would not have had to happen in the contemporary world. It wouldn't have to be a modern fabrication in order to do that. The grammatical errors, the things he calls grammatical errors, I've also pointed out in my work, are in part the kind of language that a native Coptic speaker would use. We have cases of them in ancient manuscripts, ancient papyrus texts that are indisputably ancient, and they appear there. So sadly, I haven't found that much in his work. I haven't found anything in his work that would actually indicate any positive evidence that this text was a fabrication in the modern period.
Apologies. What else could I say?
also said in an interview, this is a quote, when you have all the evidence pointing in one direction, it doesn't make it 100%, but history is not a place where 100% is a common thing. Do you think there's any chance that somebody could have taken some old papyrus and forged this? Because I know there are limits to the analysis of the ink itself because the document is so small and it could be destroyed.
Actually, you know, the scientists have done a remarkable job of proving, at least to me, that the fragment itself, the material part of it, you know, that the papyrus and the ink are themselves ancient. It would be, you know, relatively easy, I think, as people have pointed out before, to get a piece of papyrus that's ancient and then write on it. Much, much more difficult to actually fabricate ink in the modern period that would replicate the carbon characteristics of ancient ink. So this is practically impossible.
I wish I was like you.
The document doesn't necessarily prove that Jesus has had a wife. You've said that on multiple occasions. But if authentic, what does it prove? That at least 700 years after Christ was born, that a community in Egypt believed that Jesus had a wife and that that wife could have been his disciple?
I think that the fact that it says, Jesus said to them, my wife, someone produced this document. You know, I really appreciate your saying that this is not evidence that Jesus was married, that the historical Jesus had a wife. That remains true, whether it's a modern production or an ancient text. But given that it's an ancient text, then the question is, who was writing it? What early Christians, what were they saying about this? Why did they write such a thing? And now that we know, because of the radiocarbon dating that Noreen Turas at Harvard did, showing that it belongs to the somewhere around the 7th to 9th century, she puts the date, I think, at 741 as kind of a mean date. Mm-hmm. We want to ask, you know, what are Christians doing with this text in that period in Egypt? This is the early Islamic period. It's quite fascinating. I myself think that this is just a copy that we have now existing, and that the text itself was probably composed much earlier. And at that period, it would have been during controversies over questions about Christian sexual ethics. That is to say, is it better for a Christian person to be married and to have children, or to be a virgin and celibate? Or indeed, must one be a virgin and a celibate in order to be a true Christian? And I think this fragment then would belong to that kind of question from that early period.
Oh,
course, it brings up all sorts of questions, too, about the modern church and the role of women in the modern church. But what do you say to those who argue that in that context, that it's just too perfect, that it's a small piece of papyrus that could have been cut from a larger document, and that somehow this little piece addresses an issue that is so hotly debated today?
Yes, well, it's unfortunately, or perhaps interestingly enough, the case that the questions about women's discipleship, about women being fully capable, especially, see, I think the main issue in this fragment, as we have it, is that it says that women who are wives and mothers can be completely disciples of Jesus. The fact that those kinds of issues or raging in the early church already in the first century in the letters of Paul and continue to be raging in our own time period is very interesting. But it doesn't show us that the fragment could only belong now or could only belong then, since those issues continue.
So many issues raised by this, and it's really a fascinating conversation and a fascinating document.
Very powerful stuff. What more do you want?
Now, go find the others.com.
Self-sacrifice is the law of our age.
Self-sacrifice? But it is precisely the self that cannot and must not be sacrificed. A man's self is his spirit. It is the unsacrificed self that we must respect in man above all.